Hello and welcome to the first Arsenal Beat special of the season. Just a week on from the anniversary of his sacking and ahead of Saturday's trip to Villa Park, the Arsenal Beat will be focusing on all things Unai Emery. I'm Max Jones and I'll be speaking to journalists in Spain, France and England to get the lowdown on Emery's managerial career from the humble beginnings to his Europa League glories, what comes next to Aston Villa and of course why it all went wrong in North London. Emery's coaching career started at a young age after a premature end to his playing days. And after developing his methods in the lower leagues, he ultimately became a success in Spain. This is Spanish football expert and contributor to ESPN and The Guardian, Sid Lowe, speaking to us from Madrid about the early years of Emery's time in the dugout.
Unai Emery was a relatively average footballer. But always a footballer that I think had a degree of intelligence that set him apart from others. There's a reason why he starts to coach immediately, and it's because they already see that in him. They see, I think, not just the kind of technical capacity, but the enthusiasm, the willingness to dissect the game, the desire to do so, you know, that kind of sense that maybe he can find an element of the game that no one else has seen, to be watching it really closely, there's a lovely Spanish word, which I think defines Unai Emery really well, which is pesado, which literally means heavy, but what it really means is kind of, he's a pain in the ass. You know, he's always going, he's always wanting more. He's always trying to find that angle that other people haven't got. He's looking for information all the time. And I think even as a player, that was there. And the final end point of his career was a knee injury. But I think in a way, that was probably always coming. Yeah, that his career wasn't necessarily going to reach him to the very top. But I think obviously it's probably worth us remembering here that the very worst players in the third division are still absolutely brilliant. And he had a view for the game. And then he also, the knee injury and the timing gave him an opportunity at Lorca, who were in Segunda B at the time. Now, Segunda B is Spain's third tier in theory, but it's a third tier that at that stage was made up of 420 team divisions. So, you know, it's anywhere between third and seventh, depending on your level within it. It's regionalized. And that was the, if you like, the starting point for him. But there was definitely an energy, an enthusiasm, a desire for information about him that set him apart. I think the adaptation for Unai from player to manager was possibly, I mean, it would have been difficult, there's no doubt about that. But listening to the way that he has talked about his career and watching the way that he's coached in his career, and really and truly, I remember having this conversation with him, I don't know what it was now, 3 or 4 years ago, about the kind of, if you like, the experience of coaching, and him essentially saying there's really no difference between coaching Arsenal and coaching Lorca, except for one thing, and that is everything that goes with it. The actual footballing side of it doesn't change enormously, but the degree of pressure changes, the level of kind of interest, if you like, in it changes. And I mean interest in both senses, you know, the interest in how many people are interested in it, but also the other elements, you know, the financial elements, the sponsorship elements, the sense of a kind of a social profile, the sense of fame, all of those things that impinge upon the way that you manage players and the way that you handle a dressing room. But I think the transition from player into manager was not so difficult, partly because the transition begins at Segunda B level. So it's not, you're not suddenly thrust into a dressing room in the limelight, you're suddenly famous. No, your level of scrutiny on a public in a public sense, remains similar. I think the personality of him meant that some of the things that he did as a manager, he was already doing as a player. Some of that enthusiasm, some of that desire to seek out details, and the kind of the being on top of players, which once were teammates, but now are under him. But actually, really and truly, he was doing that anyway. And I think more than anything else, and one of the things you see with Unai Emery is it's just the enthusiasm, you know, that kind of, that almost a hyperactivity about him that means that I think actually in a way it was a good transition for him, because it was really and truly probably what he was always likely to be anyway. It's not like a lot of players. I think a lot of players, the transition into management happens because what they want to do is find an excuse to stay in the game that they've really enjoyed playing. I think the transition for management with Unai is much more, actually, this is what I wanted to do. I wanted to lead a team rather than just play in a team.
And he had quite an interesting few years, obviously, Almeria, then 2008 to 2012, is at Valencia. From there, he makes kind of a strange move to Spartak Moscow before ultimately returning to Spain. What do you think prompted that move, and how, maybe why did it work or perhaps not work, in your opinion, at those bigger clubs there?
I think what prompts the move to Spartak Moscow, to be honest, is opportunity, or the lack thereof. The Valencia, his spell at Valencia was really curious, because I think when you take a step back, and actually, you know what? You don't even need to take a step back. I think at the time, most of us could see this. What he achieved was really, really impressive. You know, consecutive Champions League qualifications. But there was, I think, still a hangover at Valencia of being a big club. And they are a big club with a huge fan base. They, of course, have won the league twice with Rafa Benitez at the start of the 2000s. They've been in two Champions League finals before that. And there was that sense that, yeah, but qualification for the Champions League is, if you like, fulfilling objectives. It's the basics. It's not necessarily what excites us. There was, I think, a degree of criticism about the way that they played, and the sense that while they earned those Champions League places, they were a long way off the top. I don't have the figures to hand, but I think I'd be right in saying that they were in double figures for the number of points off the top they were in each of those three seasons. So although this is a team that was clearly the third best team in Spain, or the fourth best team in Spain, and really relatively comfortably so, but that Madrid and Barcelona were escaping. And so this isn't quite enough for a club like Valencia. I think with time, but as I say, I think most of us probably saw it then, but with time, I think people have taken a step back and thought, actually, you know what? That was really good, because there was an underlying trend at Valencia of the best players departing and a decline. So I think with time, people have possibly been able to see how successful that was, or at least how meritorious it was to be able to do that. One of the things that changed, I think, when he left Valencia and went to Sevilla was actually about Sevilla. And I think it made a profound impact on him. And Unai himself tells this story that when he goes to Sevilla, having been in Russia, he goes to Sevilla. And essentially, Sevilla's built their entire identity over the last 15 years around being the team that wins the Europa League. Now, obviously, if you're a really big club, there is, I think, a tendency, or at least a temptation, to dismiss the Europa League. It is Europe's second competition. To look at it and say, well, you know, that's all well and good for a slightly smaller club, but if you really do aspire to be the best, this isn't what you should be doing. And what Sevilla have done is the opposite. There's a phrase that they use in Sevilla, nadie la quiere como nosotros, which is that no one wants it or desires it or loves it like we do. And one of the things that was drilled into Unai by staff members, by presidency, by even by some of the players when he reached Sevilla, was that qualification for the Champions League is brilliant. And of course, objectively, it's better than what we've been doing. But there is nothing that gets you going like the idea of a success, of a trophy, something that you live for. And Unai really made, and to be honest, I think Unai always had this, but he really made that message his, that idea that you play for the excitement of it, for the sense of feeling moved by it, for the sense of the kind of, if you like, the dynamism of it, the joy of it. Now, obviously, you can talk about joy and being expressed in many different ways, but for Unai, it's that idea that you go and you compete and you're trying to achieve something, you're trying to get something. And I think what his time at Sevilla did was really reinforce that, which was there at Valencia, but possibly not to the same extent. I think it changed the prioritization of competitions for him at Sevilla. And of course, that is then where he really has those moments, because of course he wins the Europa League with Sevilla repeatedly. And I think that gives him a presence, a gravitas, and a kind of a sense of glory about him. That it's true, there was, I think, at times, even in his Sevilla period, where people were a little bit unsure, but take a step back. And I think that's the one club where he's really, really fondly remembered by supporters.
What is winning those trophies, and obviously like making a bit more of a name for himself, is he ever touted for a job maybe with Real Madrid or Barcelona? Is his stock ever that high?
I've always been surprised by the fact that Unai Emery's name doesn't come up, or hasn't come up until now, when the Real Madrid job has come available. Now, for what it's worth, I think it's understandable that it didn't come up for Barcelona, because, of course, Barcelona have a very, very specific sense of themselves and the way they play and the kind of football they want to play, and also that idea of promoting from within. But Real Madrid have been through a lot of managers. And I think for a lot of managers with different stylistic traits and different approaches, and it surprises me that Unai Emery isn't one of them. And certainly when they went for Julian Lopetegui, I think Unai Emery fit very much the profile they wanted, because at that point, what they wanted was a profile of someone who'd been in Europe, a profile of someone who preferably was Spanish and had demonstrated something at other clubs in terms of success. So they looked, for example, at that stage at Néstor Valverde, Julian Lopetegui. I can't remember if there's, I think there's a third name, but the name escapes me now. And I remember at the time being told these names, but this is Unai Emery. This is exactly what he is. Now, I couldn't swear to you 100% that he wasn't on their minds, but he never emerged as a clear candidate. I think one of the reasons for that, obviously, was that sense that maybe there was a slight limitation. That step up to the next level maybe wasn't there. This brings us back a little bit to the debate at Valencia, because there was a feeling at Valencia that in that period, while they consistently achieved objectives, they didn't consistently push the big teams. There was a sense that in the really big games, it didn't quite happen. And you get this thing, I think, in Spain, possibly more than elsewhere, this idea that somehow there's either a lack of ambition or there's a lack of something there to kind of grab hold of, to say, right, this is really big. And I think there was a stylistic thing there as well, a sense at times that Unai Emery relied a little more on playing counter-attacking, that at times when the victory was within sight, he would be a bit conservative. And I think that sometimes went against him. I personally thought a lot of those accusations were unfair, but I think that identity of him was kind of hung in the air a little bit.
There's also a bit of a, I don't know whether it's a misconception in England, but certainly within mainstream media here, where he struggles to deal with big egos. So perhaps that might be the reason it didn't work out at PSG. Perhaps that might be the reason that he fell out with a number of players at Arsenal. Is that shared in Spain, or is that just complete rubbish?
I think in Spain there was the sense that it might be difficult for him with the biggest club players because of the way that he works, because he is very intense. And in truth, you know, that draws on that idea, I think, draws on two cliches. It draws on the cliche that this manager can't deal with a player with whom he's got to be sensitive and careful because he doesn't like the star. And we'll come to why in a minute, to why I don't think that really stands up. And it draws on the other cliche, which is the star doesn't want to work hard. And those two cliches sometimes come together to create this image that this isn't going to work. There's a couple of reasons why I think that falls down. If you look, for example, at what Unai Emery did with Ever Banega, who was a difficult player but played his best football under Unai Emery, I think that was very significant. I think it was partly because Emery would be open about having these kind of discussions with players. Remember him talking about trying to get through to José Antonio Reyes at Sevilla, for example, and trying to say to him, look, this is... You know, look at what you can achieve if we do this, this, and this, and it's all well and good saying that to a player. Of course, you've then got to convince him, and then you've got to keep him convinced over a long period of time. And there are some players who disengage, and there are players, there's no doubt about it, who found him hard work. Let's go back to that word of pesado. You know, that idea that this guy's a pain in the ass is a very famous story of Joaquin, the Betis winger who at the time was at Valencia with Unai Emery, and. Unai Emery Joaquin was asked about Unai Emery's team talks. And, you know, he would go and he would put a video on and he would show them what the other team were doing and so on. And Joaquin came out with this comment. He said, those team talks, the films that he put on were so long that I turned up with popcorn because, you know, we just got bored to tears by this. There's another famous one where Unai Emery admits that he would give the players a little pen drive with information on the player that they were directly up against. So, you know, the winger would get the fullback or whatever. And he would give players individual pen drives as well as the team talks. And he suspected that one of his players wasn't bothering to watch these. So one day he gave him an empty pen drive. And he asked him the next day what he thought of the player that he was facing. And the player said, oh yeah, don't worry, boss, I've watched it. I've got it all under control. He's like, hang on. I didn't give you anything on this pen drive. You are so rumbled, sunshine. And there's a comment. You know what? I can't remember who it is now, but I remember interviewing a player. I can't remember which player I interviewed. I can remember which player I was talking about. And he said that Miguel Brito, who was a fullback at Valencia, would be in the team talks asleep at the back of the room. Now, all of these, I think, are obviously slightly hammed up, but they give you an idea of the profile of Unai Emery and that idea of how it works with him. And I always found Unai incredibly engaging. But I guess if you're dealing with this day after day after day, there becomes this point at which this is difficult. And Unai made a very interesting point. I remember speaking to him once, and I think this was when he was at Sevilla, but it may even have been Valencia. And he said, look, I sometimes say to players, this is your job. Now, most people are here, you know, at that job all day. You come in and you train for a couple of hours. It's not asking that much for you to spend an extra hour doing this. It's not asking that much for you to go and do this little bit of work or this little bit of study. But of course, for some players, that was asking quite a lot. And I think Unai Emery's enthusiasm didn't always get repaid by some of the players. But then, of course, it's partly his job to make sure that that happens. I think he's learned to try and kind of manage that. At Arsenal, of course, the biggest issue he had was Mesut Ozil.
While Emery did spend a brief spell outside of Spain at Spartak Moscow, his first chance to manage away from his homeland at a top-level club came at Paris Saint-Germain in 2016. But it wouldn't go the way that Emery hoped, as French football reporter Tom Williams explains.
What could possibly have attracted Moneybags, PSG and their repeated frustrations in the Champions League to serial European trophy winner Unai Emery? I mean, that was basically it, I think. You go back to the summer of 2016 when he was appointed by PSG, and they are 5 years into the Qatari project. They have dominated Ligue 1 for the last sort of three or four seasons under Laurent Blanc. They have this very set playing style, 4-3-3, very possession heavy. And they basically sort of stroll to the title every season, but they haven't yet made a breakthrough in the Champions League. And in each of the three seasons that Blanc is there, I think I'm right in saying they go out in the quarterfinals of the Champions League. And obviously Emery has shown in the Europa League by that stage that, you know, he knows what it takes to win in European competition. So I think on the one hand, there's the appeal of his European experience and European success that he's enjoyed. And on the other hand, there's the potential for him to turn PSG into a slightly more dynamic team. I mean, they were always very good to watch under Blanc, but it was quite sort of sleepy football occasionally, whereas I think what they hoped they were getting with Emery was someone who would turn them into a slightly more modern, slightly more sophisticated team in terms of the way they approach matches.
How do you feel he was received by the fans, the players, but also the media as well?
I think there was a lot of curiosity about what he would bring. And right at the start, it was clear that he was being brought to PSG to engineer a fairly substantial tactical shift. Now, that was the whole point in him being appointed. And the end of the Laurent Blanc era was handled quite messily in that, shortly before the end of the 2015-16 season, he signed a new contract. Nasser Al-Khelaifi, the PSG president, said that he was going to be there for the foreseeable. And then in the light of a quarterfinal exit at Manchester City's hands in the Champions League, he was sacked. And if you go back to when Blanc was appointed in 2013, it was an open secret that he was not PSG's first choice. They just lost Carlo Ancelotti, who'd led them to the first title of the Qatari era. And they were turned down by a fairly substantial list of coaches, and, you know, ended up with Laurent Blanc, who did a great job, you know, who won all the domestic trophies, gave him this playing identity. Appointing Emery felt like a more strategic decision. This was a guy who was going to bring something a little bit different. So that was the kind of context to his arrival. I think the fans initially were enthused by the prospect of a guy coming in and giving the team a slightly different look, a slightly different feel. I think the fact that he committed to speaking French right from the start went down well initially. Subsequently he had the same sorts of problems that he had in England, in that, you know, people took the piss because his French was very scratchy. But I think initially, at least, people appreciated the fact that he was making that effort, and not least because, you know, there are plenty of foreign coaches who work in France who who don't make that effort and you know, spend their entire time at French clubs without speaking a word of French. And then in terms of the players, I mean, I think Emery's biggest issue throughout his time at PSG was convincing the players to play his kind of football. So they've been playing this 4-3-3, very possession-heavy system under Laurent Blanc. And he came in and he ditched the 4-3-3 for a 4-2-3-1. And it was all about verticality. That was the word that, you know, that kept coming up time and time again, getting the fullbacks further forward, getting the ball forward more quickly, and not just sort of, you know, sending the opposition to sleep with these endless passing circuits. And it would have been an interesting experiment if he'd been allowed to sort of carry it through. But very quickly, the senior players at PSG called a meeting with him and said, no, we're not up for this. We quite like the football that we were playing. We feel like the profile of player in the squad is better suited to that. And so he had to basically water down what he was trying to do. And that was a kind of constant issue for him throughout his tenure at PSG, trying to make the team slightly more dynamic, trying to make it slightly less possession based. But as so many PSG coaches have found in recent years, you know, that changing room takes a lot of convincing. And there were players who basically, you know, made it very clear that they didn't want to play his kind of football.
The abiding memory that most casual PSG watchers will have of Unai Emery's time there is the look on the touchline, 6-1 defeat to Barcelona in the Champions League. Just how big a dent did that have in the belief that they had in him?
I mean, in many ways, that was, I mean, not even the beginning of the end. I mean, that was the end. I mean, he stayed on for another year and, you know, he won plenty of trophies. But you knew watching that extraordinary game at Camp Nou that that defeat, that result would just cling to him for as long as he stayed in Paris and for much longer than that. You know, it was a seismic, historic defeat. And I think what was particularly galling for Emery and for PSG in general, and this gets overlooked, understandably, I suppose, when you consider what happened in the second leg, but PSG's performance in the first leg of that tie was a masterclass. They beat Barcelona 4-0 and they play them off the park. And this isn't the Barcelona who we've seen being torn to pieces in the Champions League in recent years. This is kind of before Barcelona started to fall apart as a club. This is the Barcelona of Messi and Neymar and Luis Suarez. They were European champions two seasons previously. And PSG ripped them to pieces at the Parc des Princes. And in that one game, they managed to play the kind of football that Emery had wanted them to play right from the start, the kind of football he had been brought to the club to introduce. And it was a masterclass in aggressive pressing, high intensity, high defensive line, smothering Barcelona. Messi barely has a kick. And the feeling that I had, I think the feeling that most sort of observers of French football had watching that was this is a watershed in the history of PSG in the Champions League. For the first time, really, in a knockout fixture, they've demolished a European heavyweight. Emery has arrived, the new PSG are here, and then 3 weeks later, they get ripped apart in even more brutal fashion by Barcelona. And you speak to people who were at PSG at the time and, you know, they still complain about the refereeing performance in that second leg. And I think some of those complaints are justified. But the thing that leaps out, and I rewatched this game relatively recently, is just the complete absence of control from PSG right from the start. I mean, they concede the first goal very, very quickly, and then they're on the back foot and they never really gain control of the match. And you know, that made it very difficult for Emery to, you know, to show that he was, you know, moving things in the right direction. There was a degree of sympathy because I think, you know, the initial reaction was, we've been robbed by the referee. You know, this is crooked. This is corrupt. You know, PSG complained to UEFA, and that was the main line of attack in the media in the weeks that followed, but you also just felt, oh man, there's a fragility here in this group of players. There's just something not quite right. And that has, that's been the case ever since. So although he stayed in the job for another year, it did, you know, inevitably undermine him. And then also, you know, a couple of months after that, they end up finishing second to Monaco in the league. So you kind of think, if you're a PSG coach, particularly at that time, well, you have to win the league because you've got more money than any other club in the division in the history of French football, and you've got to break new ground in Europe. And Emery did neither in that first season. So it was kind of hard to, it was hard to make the case that that he was succeeding in fulfilling the objectives that he'd been brought in to, you know, to achieve.
So you said that he stayed on for a year after that defeat. You had these incredible highs, best performance that they'd had in the Champions League, followed by one of the worst. What was the feeling when he did leave at the end of his two-year deal?
I think there was a feeling that he'd perhaps been miscast in a way. I mean, it was the first, you know, really big job that he'd had outside of Spain. And I think there was a feeling that as a coach, he wasn't suited to working with absolute elite level players, that he was someone who was better off at a club like Sevilla, for example, who were kind of fourth or fifth best team in La Liga, you know, have ambitions in the Europa League, that was his level. And if you look at what happened in his second season in Paris, so the summer of 2017, PSG's response to the humiliation of La Remontada is to go out and smash the world transfer record for Neymar, and then a few weeks later spend, you know, 180 million euros on Kylian Mbappe. And, you know, he was already struggling to get his message across before they arrived. And once they had arrived, it became, you know, if not impossible, then even more difficult. You have to start Mbappe, you have to start Neymar, you have to start Edinson Cavani. Angel Di Maria ends up on the bench. And it's not possible to play Emery-style football with a front three like that, who aren't going to, you know, put in the legwork. But at the same time, their quality means that, you know, you are almost guaranteed to steamroll every team you play in Ligue 1, which is what PSG did. Monaco had to sell, or decided to sell, all the players, pretty much, who'd taken them to the title in 2016-17. So their challenge falls away. And PSG strolled to the title, and I think they cleaned up in the cup competitions that season as well. But then again, in the Champions League, they fall short. Real Madrid in the last 16, Emery makes a slightly curious decision to play Giovanni Lo Celso as a number six, where I don't think he'd ever played, certainly not in his PSG career. And he gives away a penalty, plays very poorly. They lose. Neymar breaks his foot in between the first leg and the second leg, and they end up going out quite meekly. And so I think if you took the two Champions League campaigns in the round, he'd been brought in to break new ground in the Champions League. And what actually happens is PSG go out a round earlier than they had done under Blanc, having not really, you know, sort of shown any signs of progress apart from that first leg against Barcelona in 2016-17. So I think the feeling was that it just, you know, it was almost an experiment that hadn't worked. You know, let's bring in this dynamic, very forward-thinking, quite young coach, and give him a chance to give this team and this group of players a slightly different, slightly more dynamic identity, in the hope that it will enable them to break new ground in Europe. And that didn't happen. And I think with hindsight, people look back at what Emery has gone on to achieve since. You know, okay, what happened at Arsenal was a mixed bag, but, you know, winning the Europa League at Villarreal, the success he's had at Villa, he's obviously a phenomenally talented coach. And I think there is maybe some regret at PSG that you know, that talent wasn't brought to bear a little bit more. But then you look at the other coaches that have followed him, Thomas Tuchel, Mauricio Pochettino. We know these are talented coaches, but it's very difficult for coaches of that, you know, of that type to impose themselves at PSG because of all the politics around the club, because of all the big egos in the changing room. And I think Emery, in a way, was almost the first victim of that. I don't think Laurent Blanc was felt to have, you know, kind of, it wasn't so much that Emery lost the changing room, but I'm not sure he ever sort of fully had it in the first place. And so I think, you know, when he left, there was a feeling of, oh man, you know, this guy's obviously got a lot of talent as a coach, but he's just, you know, he's not the complete package, and he's not the right fit for a club of this standing.
Despite his failings in Paris, Emery would become the chosen one to replace Arsene Wenger at Arsenal. A tough challenge for any coach. Things started well for Emery, but a Europa League final defeat and a huge drop-off in results eventually saw him sacked after just 18 months in charge. James Olley of ESPN and Mark Manbryans from PA covered the majority of Emery's spell at the Emirates, and here the pair discuss how quickly things turned sour.
Mikel Arteta was very, very close to getting the job straight after Arsene left. And in fact, to the point where I think his agent, his camp, were virtually suggesting it was a done deal, only for the club to have a change of heart at the last minute. Now, I've since spoken to some of the decision makers at the club about that, and they suggest, well, actually, the agent jumped the gun a little bit and it wasn't quite as far down the line. And you never quite know whether they're rewriting history there with the benefit of hindsight. But I think we can certainly say that there was a process where they narrowed it down to two, and it was Mikel and Unai Emery. And Unai ended up getting the job, I think, because although he apparently impressed in his interview, I remember being told at the time that his knowledge of the academy players in particular was remarkably impressive for a manager who obviously hadn't managed in England, and you know he didn't have a head start in terms of knowing the league and obviously the club specifically. And it stuck in my mind that really impressed them with the way that he communicated, because communication ended up becoming a pretty major problem for Unai Emery during his time at Arsenal. But for whatever reason, he can clearly deliver a strong PowerPoint presentation, because you know that was one of the key factors in it. And look, I mean, I suppose obviously he had a great record in the Europa League. He had a lot more experience. Clearly, Mikel at that point hadn't even been a manager, so you sort of suspect that they erred perhaps on the side of caution a little bit, to think, well, if you are narrowing it down to those two, you think, well, there is at least one person here with a track record, and maybe he's a slightly more of a safer bet after someone obviously as experienced as Arsene being there for so long.
Yeah, I think as well, you look at it and it was a bit of Ivan Gazidis' baby a little bit, wasn't it? That, you know, after those autocratic years of Wenger, I think Gazidis had this master plan of getting a head coach rather than a manager and putting all this team in place around him. And I think we've heard and we know already that Emery fits that mould, really. I think the issue was that they were trying to run before they could walk, in the sense that they put all these people in place and these bits of the jigsaw, and within months, you know, it was almost falling to bits. And that's not Unai, that's not the football side of it, which was at that point going quite well. But, you know, Raul Leahy came in, Sven Mislintat came in. They then left, you know, over the course of time, because he does himself, who'd come up with this, you know, this brave new world. He left. And let's not forget, he tried to install this while Wenger was still there. Wenger was pushing against this for a long time. I think James, wasn't it, in a press conference when he said, why would I need a director of football? Like, what would he do? Come in and direct the traffic? You know, it's not exactly a great joke, but you could see that Wenger definitely was pushing against it. So the moment they could get him out the door, it felt like we're going to move in this direction, and Emery was clearly the guy they felt at the time would drive that.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, I presume we're going to come on to sort of discuss about how it kind of went wrong, and I do think that is a massive part of it, because yeah, you're right. I mean, Wenger quietly had his autonomy stripped in the final sort of year, 18 months of his time there, and Gazidis appointed, I think it was nine new department heads the idea being that there would be this structure at the club that would operate not independent of the head coach, but impervious to a change of head coach, really, that there would be a structure there that would be that would last, and that would be the essence of Arsenal, and they would find a coach to fit within that. Now, I quite like Ivan Gazidis, but I think his decision to make those appointments and then leave, I think it was it September, I think that got announced, and I think he left in the December of that year. That, I think, in the sort of annals of history, that will go down as a bit of a mistake in terms of almost opening up a kind of, it wasn't like a civil war at the club, but a power struggle effectively started, because the man who had appointed all of these people, that put them in place, they're all newly in post. The whole club was adjusting after being essentially moulded in the image of one man for 20-odd years in Arsene Wenger. Suddenly, the guy who's made all these appointments leaves. And then you've got a lot of quite ambitious people in new positions, clearly see a lot of fertile open ground ahead of them in terms of being able to improve the team and improve the fortunes of the club. And there's a power grab. There were disagreements over how they were going to recruit players. There were disagreements about the playing style. There were disagreements in terms of, on a basic level, of do we use our in-house data and our analytics, and is that how we approach transfers, or do we use our relationships with agents? And obviously, every technical director or senior recruitment official has got their own agents that they tend to work with, and they have their relationships that they play to, and that clearly can then influence transfer policy if that's not managed at the top level by a chief executive. And the fact that Ivan left and the timing of that really contributed to an instability at the higher level that really undermined Unai Emery's tenure, which is not to say that Emery didn't make a lot of mistakes, because I think he did. But I do think that wider picture is really important to remember when you contrast that with Mikel and what he's got now. And actually, as Mark said earlier, they went from one manager making all the decisions to 9 department heads, and they've now gone back to a manager with Per Mertesacker at the academy, technical director with Edu, and then Josh kind of sitting above that as kind of they're the decision maker. It's almost gone back to what they tried to get away from, and Emery really got caught in the middle of that transition away from and pivot back to it.
That's a very good background. So we'll come on to the mistakes on the football pitch in a bit. For now, I just wanted to pick up on something that James mentioned about Ivan Gazidis constantly saying in briefings that he was wowed with this digital, with this detailed presentation. I can remember hearing all about Unai and his plan for Ainsley Maitland-Niles and for Reece Nelson and these talented kids coming through. How surprised then, Mark, were you when you turned up for that first press conference and we got to hear Emery for the first time?
Yeah, it was a strange one, really, because I remember getting the call that there was going to be a press. It all happened really quickly, that Emery unveiling. I think it was at a time when everyone kind of considered that Arteta was actually going to get it, I think. I think that's fair to say. He was the front runner at the time, everyone felt. And we all turned up. It was at the Emirates, wasn't it? Which was, they packed that press room out more than it ever has been for a post-match press conference, I think. And, he went to France and wanted to speak French when he took the PSG job and was ridiculed for it. So to then come to England and say, actually, I'm going to do this in English, when the club had prepared everything for him to have a translator and all that kind of stuff. Is it foolish? Probably in the long run, because, if you're winning every week, maybe you get away with it. But the fact it was such a struggle, and, the media in particular have been spoiled with Wenger for years, even when they weren't winning on the pitch, the trophies weren't coming, but he was delivering in the press conference every week. And it was very feast to famine then when Unai came in. You can't knock a man for coming in and trying. I think he thought, if I can project myself in English and get my ideas across in English, I'll win them over quicker and they'll be on my side. But it very much got to, it was very attritional with Emery in the end, in terms of in terms of trying to get things out of him, even towards the very end. You know, his English didn't improve much over the course of it, but that very first press conference, you know, some of the things he was saying just didn't really make sense. And then after he'd done the main press conference, a few of us went up and we sat down with him in a lounge upstairs, and he was more relaxed. But again, it was hard work because, you know, you guys, it was almost like going on holiday and you're having to try and have a broken conversation with someone in a restaurant or in a bar or anything like that. And things get lost in translation. And I think he was nervous. And yeah, so it didn't get off on the best foot for him, definitely.
Do you feel, James, that makes it even more of an issue? Because although it is obviously admirable and you want to come across in the best possible way, you're leaving a lot of room for interpretation with a new group of journalists who, you know, you've never dealt with before. They don't know about you. They don't know that message that you're trying to communicate. So leaving them to sort of guess at what you're actually meaning, obviously a strain on the press officers as well. But it's that fine line, isn't it, between making a good first impression but then also being able to communicate your ideas and why you are the right person to take over.
Yeah, you're right. And I mean, it's a point I've made on this podcast before, that I think Arsenal's problem over a number of years has been a failure to communicate their longer term plan effectively. And so it's often said, oh, you know, one defeat there is a disaster, and one win, they're going to win the league. That only happens when there's not a structure for those results to fit within, a narrative for those results to fit within. And Arsenal have been on the back foot for years in communicating what their actual plan is. And, you know, I know that Ivan Gazidis, for example, regrets not being more communicative with the fans. I think he regrets not being able to convey a genuine sense of passion and direction and purpose about the club. And he's certainly not alone in being guilty of that. I think that, you know, that's something the club, to be fair, have got better at in the last kind of couple of years. But back then, it was solely reliant on Arsene Wenger. You know, he was, you know, there, the last two or three years at that club, it was painful because you just thought he's clearly floundering here. He's clearly struggling, but there's nobody. It's actually a little bit like Gareth Southgate with England now. Like when was the last time you heard from the chairman or the chief exec coming out and saying something strong to kind of deflect a bit of the criticism away from Gareth Southgate? It's always Gareth who has to deal with every single issue. He's the one that speaks. And Arsene was the same, you know. And to sort of extend the England analogy, I think when Emery came in, it was a little bit like Fabio Capello when he got the England job, in that Capello, clearly a brilliant mind, you know, a brilliant tactical mind, has his flaws like everybody does, but clearly really intelligent, knew the game, thorough pedigree. But he could speak about 100 words of English, probably less, probably fewer. And so it makes him sound less intelligent. It's in a reductive conversation. And Emery, you know, I think if he'd had his time again, and I understand why he did it, but I think if he'd had his time again, I think he should have started in Spanish. He should have just said, look, I'm learning and I'll try the odd word, or maybe I'll do the odd, like, you know, he could answer the first question, which is always a dolly up in a presser anyway, of, you know, team news, or he could clearly have just said, yes, you know, Aaron Ramsey's fit, you know, he's not, we're not sure about him for the weekend, and then switch to Spanish. But I think the fact that he tried to do it in English was commendable, but, you know, he really didn't progress very well. And it's not as if doing those, you know, he still had his English teacher sitting in on lessons with him in the second season. And you know, he didn't really progress enough. And communication was obviously a problem for him. I remember speaking to players, the representatives of players, who would say the video meetings took forever because he couldn't communicate his message, and the video meetings would go on and on and on. And whenever I think now about, you talk about Unai now at Villa, they always talk about how detailed his video meetings are. You sort of think, well, yeah, that is a strength. And it's certainly something that they didn't do enough of when Arsene Wenger was manager. And I think initially they thought, okay, here's a guy who actually looks at the opposition and thinks, how are they going to play? And let's set up to deal with them, because it's not something that Arsene ever really focused on. Particularly, it was always we play how we play, and we will beat a team on our own terms and everywhere we go, you know.
Sid makes the point, doesn't he, that Sid would go and sit in a dressing room with him in Valencia and talk and have conversations in Spanish, obviously. And you could obviously see how passionate Unai Emery is as a football man. So I think we kind of missed out on those days of hearing his nuances and how he saw the game. You know, we were guffawing in press conferences when he was talking about Peaky Blinders and, you know, changing the orange juice in the camp and everything. And I think that was because everyone was so desperate for something from Emery that we were clutching at straws. But it's true what James said as well. Then I always remember going back to Vorskla Poltava away, which, you know, is a podcast in itself. But and we have to remember he gave Saka his debut that night, and the club, maybe in hindsight, it should have thought it through, but they brought Saka into the mix zone after the game. And, you know, the obvious question was, what's Emery done to get you to this level to play in the first team? And he basically said, look, I struggle to understand. I listened to Freddie Ljungberg, who at the time was obviously in the coaching staff, because me and a lot of the other guys, especially from the youth team, we don't really understand what Emery says. So how are you going to get your ideas across, especially when they are so nuanced and they are so in depth? That's Emery's MO, isn't it? That's how he approaches things. But if you're not picking up on those little points, then his whole plan, his whole philosophy almost is flawed from the get-go, isn't it?
We've got the background there. Let's move on to the on-the-pitch stuff. He started so well. There was that 11-game winning run, the 22-match unbeaten run. I can remember Fulham away, a 5-1 win. The Arsenal fans in the away end, we've got our Arsenal back. With all of that good feeling and sentiment around the club, how did it turn so wrong?
Well, I think it went wrong very quickly, didn't it? That's the other thing, I'm sure. I remember that day, you know, that people talk about that run. It was very... It paved over a lot of cracks, isn't it? Last year's run they had, I know they lost to Old Trafford, but under Arteta, they had that run where you felt they're building momentum, they're building ahead of steam, this could lead to something. But I think that Emery run, yeah, it paved over a lot of those early cracks. He relied a lot on Aubameyang and Lacazette. I think if you look at the goal scorers under Emery's tenure at Arsenal, there aren't many that got into double figures. I think Ramsey might be the only other player, actually. I know Joe Willock got a few as well, but he was very reliant on those individual moments of genius, which again is not really the Unai Emery way. He coaches a team, doesn't he? He's not one for the big egos, despite the fact he managed those guys at PSG in that last year. But I think as soon as the wheels started to come off, that's when it became clear. That's when the little nuggets started dropping out of the dressing room that they didn't understand what I was saying. That's when the little whispers began that, you know, some of the players weren't happy with training and these long videos and things like that. And the issue is, if you're winning, you can convince people to watch these 30 minutes. As James said, like it's probably happening at Villa at the moment, you can convince these players, you know, watch this video, focus on this, eat this, do that, because we're winning and we're changing the philosophy. But as soon as that changes and results take a bit of a nosedive, that's when the players are going to start getting restless. That's when they're not going to be doing their quote marks homework, for example. And that's when this whole plan that he has just starts to fall by the wayside. But I suppose it brings it a bit full circle as well. He had no support from a hierarchy that was still all over the place at the time. There wasn't these head honchos in place to give him support. But ultimately, on the pitch, it lies with Emery, doesn't it?
It struck me a little bit like Chelsea, actually, in that what essentially happened was, because the players, I mean, that was not a nice dressing room, let's be honest. You only need to see what happened after Emery left and the way that Arteta got the backing from the board to, I mean, not just get rid of a lot of these players, but pay them to leave the club. I mean, we're not talking about a transfer policy where the manager wants to sign a different profile of player or he wants to get one or two out. They paid multiple players, 7, 8, 9, I can't remember how many it was. There's a lot of players and a lot of money to leave. We are giving you your money now to leave us immediately. I mean, it's quite a damning indictment on that dressing room. And unfortunately at the time, you know, Emery didn't have, because there was this power struggle going on between Salehi, Mislintat, you know, all of this uncertainty at the top level of the club. The Kroenkes were less absent. Josh wasn't as fully engaged as he is now. You know, there wasn't somebody above Emery who would back him, who would say, look, this dressing room isn't great. There are some difficult decisions that need to be made. We are going to support you. And I think, you know, players aren't stupid. They do sense that when there is an absence of that kind of sort of structure that hierarchy above a manager, so they know they can undermine him. And I think that was part of the reason that it went south very quickly. I mean, let's remember, they were, what were they, 4 or 5 games away from getting into to the top four. That, you know, they obviously lost that Europa League final. That season, you know, what Arteta had to back him was the FA Cup win. Emery had won the Europa League that season. He may have been able to get to the other side in terms of being able to change this squad. I mean, you know, there were obviously a lot of changes that he wanted to make too, but he didn't have that trophy to validate him. He didn't have that success at the club to convince those above him to go and make those difficult decisions. Now, I think what happened then was he started to panic. I mean, in that season when he was sacked, I looked this up this morning, he used more players. He used 35 players and he made more half-time substitutions, 32, than any other Premier League manager in that season. Now, what does that tell you if that's not panicking? If that's not, well, I've got to change something here. I can't get rid of these players. I can't bring in a low. I mean, he brought in a few, obviously, but he can't change the entire team. He's chopping and changing because he's trying to say to them, no, I'm in control here. But the more that you do that, the more it just looks chaotic. And it reflected in the performances, you know, it became a mess. And when you're trying to play out from the back and you're trying to, you know, being functional, 4-4-2, going long, trying to stay compact is easier to coach than trying to play out from the back and taking risks in possession and players stepping out and all this. As soon as a couple of players aren't doing that, it just completely unravels. It looks horrendous. You know, and it really did for Emery at the end, and so I'm being a bit more sympathetic towards him than I thought I was going to be when I knew we were doing this, but because I do think there is another side of this, which is that he did, as I say, he chopped and changed too much, but he also didn't ingratiate himself to people. And you know, speaking to people who worked at the club at the time, I know that he didn't make an effort to get to know people, to forge relationships with people. I was told once that, you know, 6 months into the job, he was doing some media and he thanked his translator at the end of it and called him by the wrong name. And you sort of think, this is a guy you're sitting next to every week. And it's not a massive, you know, it's just a faux pas really, but I think it's symptomatic of the fact that he didn't ingratiate himself to people. He wasn't able to communicate. He was quite a loner, I think. I was told it was a restaurant he quite liked in St. Albans, but he didn't really go out very much. He didn't really have many hobbies. He wasn't kind of, you know, part of the fabric of the town, of the region, if you like. He felt a little bit isolated. And the players by the end, you know, they were openly mocking him. They would mock his poor English. They would take the piss, basically. And, you know, once you've got a squad that's doing that, unless you've got the hierarchy behind you who are prepared to come out publicly or even privately do it at Colney and say, look, sorry, guys, but this guy's here to stay. This is the bigger plan. You're either on board or you're not. Then it's only going to go one way. And obviously that's what happened.
So let's talk then about the game that finished it all off. Home Europa League defeat to Frankfurt. Kamada, I think it was, a goal-scoring midfielder that certainly is not a goal-scoring midfielder. I'm not sure he'd ever scored in his career before that game, but he struck twice. Felt as though the tide had been turning for a while. Even before that game kicked off, there was this growing sense that this guy will not see out the season.
I think it was, the writing was very much on the wall, wasn't it? I think that game stands out in the memory. You'd probably put that one alongside the Palace game in the league the year before when he changed so many players and they lost and that basically cost them the top four. But it was all over the shop, wasn't it? It was Keystone Cop stuff almost from a team that, you know, in a tournament that he prides himself on winning so many times with a team that should be steamrolling an Eintracht Frankfurt team at home. The crowd had almost given up on him, I think, by that point, because it was abundantly clear before that kickoff, maybe even a week, 2 weeks before, that Unai Emery was not going to be that manager by the end of the season. I think we knew it. I think the club knew it. And even the fans really knew it. There was such an apathy in the stadium, really, around games at that time. But that was just very much a straw that broke the camel's back. But the decision had already been taken. He was already a dead man walking before that game. So what kind of, you know, commitment does he have to a team when he knows that he's walking on the Friday morning anyway? You know, he's not going to be running around. He's not going to be making sure everyone's doing what he asked them to be doing, because he's just lost what it was and still is the biggest job he's ever had, PSG included, I think, obviously. And he knew it was coming to an end. So I think that was, it was a nadir in terms of his reign, but also it was so obvious what was happening at the time that no one expected anything otherwise, I think.
I think they lost at Leicester just before the international break, and everybody thought he was going to go then. And yet, inexplicably, they... I mean, again, a lot of this comes back to I don't want to, again, lay it on Ivan's door, but, like, the fact that he'd gone, I think, you know, if Ivan had still been there, or they'd had a chief executive who had, you know, had the experience and the authority to intervene, I don't think that would have dragged on as long as it did. But I think because there, everybody, you know, senior level was kind of looking out for their own backs, really, they sort of thought, well, you know, so I'm not going to sack him. I'm not going to take responsibility for this. You know, I didn't appoint him. It's not anything to do with me, you know. That there was maybe a bit of buck passing going on, and obviously the sort of hope that somehow he would turn it around. But I mean, the atmosphere around the training ground was so toxic at the time that anyone with their finger on the pulse at what was going on would have been able to sort of say, well, look, actually, this is just this something's got to change here. And obviously at that time, you know, well, it's always the case that it's easier to change the manager than the players. But what they've obviously done subsequently with Arteta is effectively back the manager and change the players. So, you know, it's something that I would want to ask Mikel next week, actually, because I don't think he's ever really been asked about this, about whether you'd rather be, you know, there's always that line about you want to be the guy that follows the guy, right? You don't want to be David Moyes. You want to be the guy after David Moyes, and I know that didn't go well, but the point being is that you don't want to immediately follow the legend, because there's just too much to do. The job is too great. You know, with the benefit of hindsight, Mikel has benefited hugely from Emery having to take those shots. And that's, again, not to say that Emery didn't make a lot of mistakes, because he did. And I think Emery's a better manager for it. I think, you know, it's very odd to see this kind of view now that, oh, because he's doing really well at Villa, Arsenal made some sort of massive mistake with him, because that's a really, really simplistic way of looking at it. Yes, he was a better manager than he showed at Arsenal, but he's a better manager because of what happened at Arsenal, now at Aston Villa.
A return to the comforts of La Liga followed for Emery when he was appointed head coach at Villarreal. Given his previous record in Spain, it was no real surprise when success soon followed, as Sid returns to explain.
The decision to bring him to Villarreal is really interesting, and I think tells us a lot about him, and or at least tells us a lot about the perceptions of him. Now, obviously, those perceptions of him, in a way, are very, very simplistic, which is to say, this guy won the Europa League with Sevilla 3 times. This guy got to a Europa League final with Arsenal, albeit didn't win it. This guy has won stuff. Villarreal are, in many ways, they're often seen as a model of a club. Stability, although actually in recent years, the stability with the managers has been a bit of a myth. But anyway, the idea of Villarreal is that stability, play nice football, great youth system, a really good ecosystem around the club, that players play largely without pressure. They play very nice football. They're very comfortable there. There's a stability of players that they stay for a long time. There's not a huge overturn of players, even if there sometimes is with managers. A very powerful presidential figure, and a club that has been enormously successful in terms of this being a club that only ever got into the first division at the back end of the, I think it was 99 that they first came up. So this is a club with a 25-year first division history. And apart from that, a really tiny and largely insignificant football club that has done this extraordinary thing. But in all of that period, despite them having reached, I think I would be right in saying, 5 European semi-finals, they'd never reached a Copa del Rey final. They'd never won anything. They actually were in not a bad place when they brought Unai Emery in. There was a sense, my mind's gone blank, I think it was Javier Calleja was the coach. I'm pretty sure it was Javier Calleja the coach. There was a sense that what Calleja had done was fine. You know, he'd achieved all of the objectives that they wanted him to achieve. They played quite nice football. They qualified for Europe. They were doing everything you could realistically ask a manager to do. and they got rid of him for Unai Emery. And there was a little bit of a sense that, hang on, this isn't entirely fair. But this is what I mean by it says something about Unai Emery's kind of identity in Spain. But there was a sense that, yeah, but really and truly, this is an upgrade. And really and truly, this is the man that says the one thing this club has never done, which is actually win something, this guy can do it. Partly because he is Mr. Europa League. But more than that, just this, just that sense that he will turn the screw a little bit. He will just take them on that little bit. And it may well be, and actually this was, I think, more or less the case, it may well be that in the day-to-day approach, and that we might watch some games in the league and we might not, but there will be something about them in knockout competition that will be stronger because it's Unai Emery. And of course, he then went and won the Europa League with them in an extraordinary final, an extraordinary run to the final as well. And then, of course, he did brilliantly in the Champions League with them, reaching the semi-final. But I think that that decision to employ him, I think, says a lot about how he was seen. So this is a guy that I think at the very, very top level, some people thought, still not entirely sure. And I personally thought that was a little unfair, but there was this idea that maybe there's that sort of sense that there isn't always the step forward. There's sometimes a little bit conservative. There's sometimes a little bit reactive. But you know what? If you've got a good team that doesn't seem to be able to take that final step, albeit in the Europa League, not in the Champions League, this is the guy that can do that with you. And that was how it played out. It's difficult to kind of judge his standing in Spain because, of course, the Spanish structure of Spanish football is kind of different. So in other words, really and truly in Spain, if you're saying, OK, who's absolutely elite, was Madrid and Barcelona. There's only two clubs. Now, one of those isn't going to go to Unai Emery for obvious reasons. I actually think it's perfectly plausible that at some stage, particularly if Aston Villa continue to do really good things with Unai Emery, that at some stage he does become a candidate for Real Madrid. The third club, obviously, where you could say, OK, this is someone at a genuinely big club, is Atletico. But Atletico's so tightly bound up with Diego Simeone at the moment, and he's only recently renewed a contract, that that doesn't become an option. But to put this into context for you, I think that over the last year or so, when there's been doubts about whether Simeone continues, Unai Emery is absolutely one of the men that people think about as a potential Atletico Madrid manager. So potentially a guy taking over a club that could win the league. And so I think there's been a little bit of resistance to Unai Emery in Spain. But the resistance, I think, does come with recognition that actually, you know, what this guy's done is really pretty impressive.
Emery's achievements at Villarreal once again saw him catching the eye of potential Premier League suitors. And he was soon back in England in November 2022 when he took a job at a struggling Aston Villa. Charlotte Dunker from The Times has been watching his reign at close quarters and talks here about how Emery has fared.
I think when Emery arrived, obviously, the club was at a low ebb. Gerrard had just left, and it was an experiment that didn't work out as people were hopefully thinking. Obviously, Steven Gerrard had won the league in Scotland, but that was his only real managerial experience. So he was very green when you look at it that way. And I think there was a lot of potential. There was a lot of expectation because everyone knows what he did as a player in the Premier League. And I think if you look at this group of players that are there, it's a very similar group now to what Gerrard had. And if you look to what Emery is doing, I think everyone could see there was the potential within the squad and it just wasn't working. So obviously he was sacked after they were left in the relegation zone. And then the next thing, Emery was appointed. So yes, it definitely was a welcome one, especially when you look at the caliber of manager they were getting in terms of he's won 4 Europa League titles, he's had success abroad. I'm sure we'll get onto what happened at Arsenal, but I think the fans were looking at it as in, this is a really experienced manager who knows how to win, who is coming into this team that's already got the foundations of something that could be quite good.
Was there any hangover from his reputation at Arsenal? Were there any doubts at all among the fan base thinking, well, look, he's come to England before and it's not gone to plan. How are we to expect it's not going to be the same again?
Yeah, from what I could see in terms of the fan reaction, I don't think there was any doubts because it hadn't worked for Emery in the Premier League the first time around. I think I don't speak to that many Arsenal fans, but looking at it from the outside in, to me, it looked like it was sort of a poison chalice when you've got someone that was that experienced as Arsene Wenger obviously such a hero and a legend at the club to leave, whoever replaced him in some ways was never going to succeed in the way that many people expected. So I think a lot of people took that into consideration. He clearly went away after that, a bit like a wounded animal, but he's gone away and he's picked himself up. He's continued winning abroad and then he's come back. And I think obviously he could have gone to Newcastle. He decided for his own reasons not to go there. So he's not just jumped at the first choice to come back to the Premier League. I think what he's done is he's waited until he knew that opportunity was right. He knew the project was right. So from what I saw, I don't think there was any fear from fans that there was any hangover after people say he failed in the Premier League the first time around.
Do the club perhaps feel quite lucky to have attracted someone like him, given that he might even have been able to go on to bigger clubs, in air quotes?
I think if you asked anyone at the club in terms of in the hierarchy, if they were lucky to attract someone like Emery, they would say that it is a consequence of their ambition and the project that they've been building. So ever since they were taken over, there's been a lot of investment within the squad. They were in the Championship when Dean Smith came in. He got them promoted. He started to lay the foundations. There was a nice moment actually on Sky a few weeks ago before the West Ham game when Emery thanked Dean Smith for the work that he'd done. And I think people sort of forget that because they think, all right, well, he got us promoted out of the Championship. He kept us in the Premier League. And then Gerrard came in and he was sacked. So I think for the owners, it's all been about a project. And I think when they first arrived here, their statements that they came in were about their ambition and sustainability and how they wanted to bring success to the team. I think Unai Emery is exactly the sort of manager that they envisaged that they could get. And it's only through the work that they've been doing in the past few years that they've been able to attract someone of such a high calibre as Emery.
One of the issues that he had during his time at Arsenal was dealing with the media. His English wasn't perhaps as good as many would have hoped it would have been. So he became a bit of a mocked figure. It felt a bit like his attitude towards the end, towards the media, had changed. And he didn't trust them. So working with him as regularly as you do, what is his relationship like now with the English press?
That's a really interesting question in terms of what is his relationship like with the media, because I think even now, still now when the cameras are on, I'm not saying he's nervous, but he's very conscious about how he's coming across and what he's saying. Because like you say, if we look back at his treatment, when he was at Arsenal, he was ridiculed, wasn't he, in terms of like his use of the English language. I'm not sure about anyone that's listening to this podcast, but I certainly couldn't go to a different country and suddenly start taking questions in a foreign language and understanding them and answering fluently for it to be broadcast all over the world and to be taken to pieces by people like myself as well, because you're always looking for hidden meanings in what people are saying. So I think he was very wary coming back in terms of press conferences and stuff. So he's brought with him an assistant called Damian Vidagani. He sits next to him in press conferences. He's not a press officer. He's more like his personal assistant, but someone just does everything for him, really helps him out. And I think he's sort of there as a safety blanket. And I don't think he had that at Arsenal. So it's sort of, he knows he can go to him and he can say, he understands, I'd say, 98% of the questions that are put to him. I mean, you've got a lot of different accents coming at him as well. I've got a very northern accent. You've got a lot of people with strong Brummie accents. So it's not even just the language that he's got to contend with, it's the dialect as well. So there's probably only 2% of questions where he goes to Vidagani, or he'll go to him just to ensure that he's definitely understood what the question was. So I think that shows from his experience at Arsenal in terms of he's clearly still worried about how he's perceived in the media, and he doesn't want to come across as how he did the first time because he was ridiculed so heavily. But from my personal experiences with him, he seems a lot more relaxed when the cameras aren't on him. My colleague Jonathan Northcroft did an exclusive interview with him at the training ground a few weeks ago, and I was speaking to someone else at the club and they said they've never seen him so relaxed with someone in the media. And there was no cameras, there was nobody else there. And because he's so enthused about football, as we all know, they were saying he could have just gone on and spoken for hours and hours and hours. And he was so animated and relaxed and keen to chat, which if you watch him now in a press conference, you don't the same thing doesn't necessarily come across. So yeah, I think he was burned the first time around and he's still learning from that mistake. But I definitely think his English has improved even since the first day he stepped in at Aston Villa to now. He's still learning, but there's definitely no criticisms from me over it.
Do you feel that there's a belief that he can take Villa even further than he is already doing?
Yeah, I think there's a really strong belief that if we talk about where they are at the minute, obviously we're talking top four. So I think we'd have to compare it to last season. They finished seventh. They qualified for the Europa Conference League. Is the belief that he can take them further than that? Of course it is, because when he came in, this was a team that was in the relegation conversation. I don't think anyone in their wildest dreams would have imagined that when he came in as manager, that by the end of the season, the conversation would have been European places. So if he can do that in his first season, which wasn't a full season in charge, now he's got all this structure in place behind him as well. He's bringing in players that he wants to, his current players that were already there and now used to his systems. I think he can only go and get better. So they've got a really key run of games coming up against teams who they need to show that they can beat if they want to continue to have that belief that they can exceed what they did last season.
At Villa, it seems like he's given a lot of players more freedom to be able to play off the leash. Is that something that you think he has brought in himself, or is that the players that are taking that opportunity?
I think he's put a system in place that allows them, providing they do the basics right in what he wants, which seems the basics seems to be the longest list of all time, and sort of like ball retention and that sort of stuff. If they're doing that, I think he's quite keen for them to express themselves on the pitch. And obviously, I don't think it's just expressing themselves. I think it's the fact that someone like Ollie Watkins, for example, now knows exactly what his role is. So maybe he looks more free than he looked previously. Is Unai Emery bringing a different sort of attacking style? He's just bringing a different sort of game to them all together. And I think if they all know their roles so diligently, as he drills into them time after time in those long, long training sessions that we've heard about, I think it makes them look freer and makes them look like a more fluid attacking outfit. But I think that's just because they're more cohesive and they know their roles on the pitch. It seems like a pretty harmonious group of players at Aston Villa. I think if we go back to his time at Arsenal, like you said, there was the very public fallings out, but he's going to have grown as a manager, isn't he? You've got to take experiences like that and learn from it. Maybe he would look back at that episode and think, I wouldn't necessarily do the same thing again. So he's grown as a manager. He's more experienced. He's dealt with far more players. And he doesn't come across, when you speak to him in person, as being like the most chatty, over-exuberant man. But when you talk to the players, they all seem to really get on with him. And I think you look what happened under Gerrard. Mings, for example, was stripped of the captaincy. He was dropped. When Emery came in, it was a clean slate for everyone. He's clearly got players that he prefers as his first starting 11. Of course he has, but you've still got players like, I did an interview with Youri Tielemans, who was obviously great for Leicester and then has struggled to get in the team at Aston Villa. It'd be very easy. And there were some reports out there saying he'd fallen out with the manager. I spoke to him. He said he hadn't. And it was the point was that Emery believed in him and that it was such an adaptation from going the way that Leicester played to the way that Villa played, that it was taking such a long time for him to break into the team. So I think there's been small narratives going around that people have fallen out with him. But when you speak to people there, everyone seems to be really enjoying it. And obviously, look where they are in the table. Like, they're playing great football. They're on a great run of form. They're in Europe. I don't think there's many reasons for them to be upset at the moment.
Having heard from so many reporters who have covered all aspects of Unai Emery's managerial career so far, we asked Sid, Tom, James, Mark and Charlotte to answer a simple question. Just why did it not work for Emery at Arsenal?
So why didn't it work for Emery at Arsenal? I think in a similar situation to what happened at Manchester United after Sir Alex Ferguson retired, whoever succeeded Arsene Wenger was going to find it very difficult, because this was a club that had been sort of enthralled to the same footballing culture for, you know, over two decades. And then suddenly a new man comes in and wants to change things and wants to bring his own ideas to bear, and perhaps didn't always have the requisite tact to do that. Perhaps tried to go too fast, too quickly. You know, despite clearly having lots of good ideas to bring to the table. So I think it was probably another case of a big job at a big club arriving for Emery at a time in his career when he, you know, perhaps wasn't quite ready for the challenge of balancing the on-pitch side of things, which is his domain and where he is, you know, pretty much peerless, and all the rest.
The main difference at Villa is that he's been able to fully concentrate on the football. There's been no side politics. He's basically been given full control at the football club. He's brought in Vidagani, who I mentioned. He's brought in Monchi, and the three of them are able to control everything that goes on there in terms of the football side. But that leaves Emery to do what he does best, coaching and managing the games. Everything else is dealt with by the other two. And I'm not sure he had that support system in place at Arsenal.
I don't think it worked for him because, well, he was cut off at the knees almost immediately with this whole change in the hierarchy. I also think he might have been a wrong man at the wrong time. You know, he'd won these trophies with smaller clubs and then went to PSG, which was the biggest job he ever had, and messed it up. So you could go into any meeting and say, this is my PowerPoint presentation. But if you were anti-Unai Emery's appointment, you just have to say, well, what happened here? And why is it going to be different? And it turned out it wasn't any different. He struggled with the egos of Ozil and Aubameyang, as he struggled with the egos in Paris. I just think for him, it was the wrong job. I think it was too big. I still think there's a massive question mark over whether he can do it at the very highest level. He's doing a great job at Aston Villa. But I just feel that he was never the right man for that appointment. And had there been a better and more, I suppose, more in touch team ahead of him, above him at Arsenal, he would never have got that job to begin with.
In terms of Unai Emery's time at Arsenal, let me give you, I suppose, his view of it, which possibly is one-sided. But I think his view of it would be that he didn't always have the authority to make one or two big decisions, that key players, in particular the guys that he saw as captains, were absent or departed at points at which he didn't want them to do so, that he was unlucky enough to have lost the Europa League final, which could have created a platform to then go on and become a team that competes for the league title, that he did genuinely have a problem with a handful of players, in particular Mesut Ozil, and everything that Mesut Ozil symbolised. It's not just about Mesut Ozil the player or the person, it's almost more about what Mesut Ozil meant as a kind of a figure, and so I think for Unai that would be the great frustration, and you know the thing that everybody latched onto with the good evening and the English speaking. I think that is a double-edged sword, and I actually think that is opportunistic as well. So coach speaks slightly ropey English, but hey, he's giving it a go and he's winning, everyone thinks it's fine. Coach speaks slightly ropey English and things start to go wrong, it becomes a stick to beat him with, which strikes me, to be honest, as a bit facile and possibly a little unfair.
I think it was a failure of communication at all levels, ultimately. I think it was a failure of the club to communicate the direction they wanted to go in effectively after Arsene Wenger. I think it was a failure on Emery's part to convey his message effectively and to control what was a very difficult dressing room. Now, that's not to say you can't have sympathy for him. And, you know, history, subsequent events have borne out the fact that the club collectively have come to the conclusion that a lot of those players deserve to be jettisoned. So, in a way, that vindicates Emery with the benefit of hindsight. But at the same time, his inability, I think, to impose himself on the club is symptomatic of what was a failure of his ability to speak English fundamentally, And secondly, is man management. And as Mark says, you know, we've seen that replicated at Paris Saint-Germain. And I think what we're seeing at Aston Villa is the product of a manager learning and improving, both in terms of his communication and his man management. I don't think anybody doubts him tactically, but I think it's a sign of how far he'd fallen that the man who was hailed as the king of the Europa League ended up departing after a 2-1 group stage defeat to Eintracht Frankfurt.
The timing with which things happen is important. And I think that previous experience is important as well, including for those who don't have that previous experience. So, for example, the authority that Arteta is given post-Unai may well be, and I say this as a not as an expert at Arsenal, but you know, may well be partly a product of the fact that when Unai goes, Arsenal don't just look at this and think, Unai Emery's gone, it was his fault, we get another manager in. It's much more, Unai Emery has gone, some of the things went wrong, what were they? And are they things that we can change and improve and, if you like, mould the circumstances and the environment on behalf of the new manager? So some of those things that Unai Emery told us about, even if we didn't fix them for Unai Emery, even if we didn't say to him, OK, we'll deal with this, this and this, and in the end they gave up the, you know, on keeping him, those lessons are still there. Those experiences are still there, which can then be applied to the guy who follows him. So had Unai Emery and Mikel Arteta gone the other way around, maybe some of those things would be the other way around. Now, I don't want to overplay that because, of course, they're different personalities. I think they have different approaches to way of playing football. I do think their footballing identities are very different, by the way. And I think it would be very unfair on Mikel Arteta to sort of say, well, you just got lucky because you followed Unai Emery, and if it had been the other way around. No, I don't think that's fair, because I think what Mikel Arteta has done so far is hugely impressive. And I think there are things that he has fixed that are nothing to do with Unai, nothing to do with the club, that it's to do with him. But I do think that those kind of transformations happen according to experiences that are not always directly about you. And I think possibly some of the things that they saw and were told about and learned during Unai Emery were dealt with post-Unai Emery and have been beneficial.